Before I start the episode again, it's time to look at the Excel spreadsheet and find out what the final 4 years will be for our upcoming, well, I'm not sure when it'll be, but some point upcoming random season. So I've asked Luke, who's my guest for this episode, to give me a number between 1 and 4, which he did. He gave me number 2. I've input number 2 into the Excel spreadsheet, and it's given me the final 4. So the final 4 years selected are 1992, 2009, 1979, and 1964. I remember a little bit of 1992, that would be an interesting one. 2009, obviously, I remember very well. Not sure if I want that one or not. It may be a good way just to get rid of it forever. I never talk about 2009 again. 79, I'm not entirely sure about. 1964, I'm excited to know what did happen and what we can do to change it. So without further ado, let's get on to the episode. Hey guys, just as well, I wanted just to jump in and say, I'm going to try and fix it up, but when I recorded this with Luke, for some reason my microphone decided to have a spaz. I sound like I'm on helium and underwater, so see if I can fix that. If I can't, apologies. I mean, Luke does a lot of the talking and his voice is fine, it's just my microphone. So if I can't fix it, I'm just going to put it out how it is. I really do apologize if it does sound terrible. Just imagine that I've got the scuba gear on and I'm having a swim outside at Shoalhaven Heads. Anyway, on with the episode, and hopefully I have fixed it. Hello, my name's David and welcome to the Hypothetic RL, a podcast about the what-ifs of rugby league history. Joining me on the line is Luke Potter, former NRL referee and celebrity in the Shoalhaven district. Hello Luke, how are you going?
David, fantastic. Thanks mate, and a wonderful intro.
Thank you Luke. I always try and give everyone the best intro I can, but usually I get halfway through it and I forget all of your achievements. So I think most importantly, what's it like to be an NRL referee?
So I guess rugby league's always been a part of my life and my family's life. Rugby league's been right through it, and I guess that's where we lead into this, but my love for the Illawarra Steelers came about. My cousin, Peter Phillips, played first grade for the mighty Illawarra Steelers back in the mid-80s, and his brother Mark also in the President's Cup. And following on from that, John Green played at the St George Illawarra Dragons, Cronulla Sharks, and now currently Damien Cook for the South Sydney Rabbitohs. So our family's been pretty blessed with rugby league, but unfortunately I wasn't really blessed with the playing team. I played until my teenage years and then turned my hand to refereeing. So, fortunate enough that I was able to, work through the ranks the same as a player, coming through local competitions and the junior reps through into grade, and then eventually getting that opportunity to join the NRL. So I did 7 years in the NRL referees and 120 first grade games. So, look, obviously not making it as a player, but certainly loved my time being out there, and I guess sort of living the same sort of life as a player, where you get to go to some of these fantastic grounds, fantastic stadiums, to be a part of a game with some high quality and world skilled players, and get to travel around a little bit as well, and probably have the best seat in the house. So rugby league's been massive in our family for a lot of years.
Yeah, what's funny, Luke, I have a very similar experience. I was a junior referee as well, so obviously not to the same level that you got to, but similar thing. I played until about under 17s, under 18s, and then university got in the way, and then a few years later I took up refereed sort of juniors, and then family got in the way of that, and so I had to kind of give it away. But definitely what you're saying, it's an amazing experience being a referee and being in the middle and what you can see from the middle of the ground. And I just can't imagine what it'll be like to referee in some of those big games, some of those big stadium, and being able to be in the middle, and when the game comes down to the crunch, it's you're making the decision, you're doing something that's part of the ambience of the game, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. And I guess, too, it probably wasn't so much game day that was the hardest or the most stressful. It was more the lead-up in the week. The training that we had to go through in the referee squad was unbelievable. We were doing triathlons. We were doing 80K bike rides. We were doing 400s on 400-metre runs. We're doing 1K time trial sprints. It was massive. We'd be, because we were based at Homebush, so we use a lot of the facilities there at the Olympic Stadium. So we're in the pool as well, doing a lot of swimming. So, look, I thought the week leading into the game was probably the hardest with all of the training involved, and game day was more the reward. But it's sort of now that I'm away from it, and like you hear about the things that the players miss, and there's always something missing out of your life. For me, it's more the 2 minute bell. I used to love the 2 minute bell, so that's where the producers from either Fox or Channel 9 would come in and ring that 2 minute bell to send the players and the match officials out to the tunnel and prepare to head out. And I used to enjoy my footy, but we'd have a little bit of fun in the warm up and muck around a little bit with the other referees and touch judges. And then once that 2 minute bell rang, you knew that was time to go to work. And then all of a sudden, you're standing in the tunnel with the likes of Jonathan Thurston and Darren Lockyer, and you're walking down a tunnel to almost 50,000 people. The fireworks are going off, the cheerleaders, and it's a real pinch yourself moment. You think, wow, how did I get here? But obviously, it was a long path to get there, but just a fantastic thing to be a part of. And that's probably something that I really miss now that I'm not there, is that whole 2 minute bell and leading into running out onto the field. It was certainly an amazing experience and a real adrenaline rush as well.
All right, so I think we'll move on for the NRL referees, because it's not the NRL referee podcast. But I do want to say, look, I do appreciate the job that NRL referees do, and you know, did in your time, continue to do now. Doesn't mean that I'm not going to stand out in the hills or get on the grandstand and just, you know, yell a few things, just try and keep them a bit honest. You know, just make sure that they're always giving my team the best possibility to win.
I'm still refereeing off the lounge at home as well, but look, I'm sure this conversation, this little piece that we're about to talk about, I'm sure there'll be some referee mentions in this one as well.
Definitely. So, look, I think it's time to get to the event that we're going to do for today. I might let you introduce it, Luke, because when we did a little sound check before, you said it quite nicely, and I think maybe it's a good idea for you to introduce us.
Yeah, so the game that I've chosen is the Panasonic Cup Final from 1989, when the Illawarra Steelers took on the high-flying Brisbane Broncos, and it was June 7, 1989. And as the reason that I chose this one is I would love to see this result change. The Steelers, unfortunately, went down in this one 22-20, but geez, they fought right to the end. And I was actually there at the game as a youngster as well. I was 13 years of age, and I remember my mum and dad picking me up early from school. I went to school at Holy Spirit College in Bulambi, and funnily enough, one of the players in his team, the Illawarra Steelers, Brett Rodwell, was attending Holy Spirit College at the time as well. So it was pretty cool to get an early mark from school and make my way up to Parramatta Stadium with my family, and probably the whole of Wollongong, as it turned out as well. They ran something like 15 buses from Wollongong, and they put on extra train services as well to get everyone from Wollongong up to Parramatta.
Yeah, we'll get to that. It looked like the crowd was probably at 90-something percent Illawarra fans, and you could tell by the boos at full-time, you know, when they were holding up the trophy and all that sort of stuff. But I think first it might be best for us to do a bit of history. So maybe a little bit of history of Illawarra itself, Illawarra Steelers, and even maybe a bit of a history of the Midweek Cup. So I'm assuming that, because you went to school at 13 at Bulambi, that you're from Illawarra, from the local area. What's your memories of the Illawarra Steelers pre-1989? And how did you become a fan?
Yeah. So I grew up in Helensburg, so that's the most northern suburb of the Illawarra. And again, my junior club, the Helensburg Tigers, we were fortunate enough to have a number of the players from our club go and play for the Steelers. The likes of my cousin Peter Phillips and Trevor Kissel and Neil Pinchinelli played for the Steelers. So I remember as a youngster going to all of these games. But growing up, the Illawarra region has always been so strong in rugby league and produced so many quality rugby league players, the like of Bob Thornton and Gary Jack and Steve Roach and the likes. And it wasn't until 1982 that the Steelers actually got bought in to the New South Wales Rugby League competition. The Illawarra Rugby League had been fighting for a number of years to try and get an Illawarra team into the Premier Sydney competition that was at the time the New South Wales Rugby League. And they certainly knocked on the door for a lot of years for this to happen. But it wasn't until 1982 that the Steelers were finally born. And played their first game out of the Wollongong Showground with the dog track around it and took on a Penrith Panthers team. So it was certainly an exciting time for the Illawarra Steelers and a club that I guess was proud of what they were able to produce in regards to local juniors. So for all of the local clubs, the likes of Dapto Canaries and Helensburgh Tigers, the Little Butchers, these were guys that were playing for the Steelers, but they came from a local club. So there was a real strong connection to the team that even at the time, there were no local games allowed to be played on the same day as a Steelers match day. So if the Steelers were at home at Wollongong Showground on a Saturday at 3 o'clock, there were no local games on that day. It was so that everyone could get to the Wollongong Showground to watch the Steelers. So a very proud history and tradition of the Scarlet and Whites and old Stanley, the Steel Avenger. And I know personally and a lot of other people here in the Illawarra and Wollongong, they certainly miss the Illawarra Steelers.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that you mentioned the local juniors in the Illawarra district and all that sort of stuff. It makes me think of the other team that came in 1982 at the same time, Canberra. Look, I know they had a few junior players through there, but they took a real different tact. They looked to bring in Queenslanders, guys like Malvin Inger and those sort of guys, and they went to bring in a couple of the New Zealand sort of internationals. So they really tried to maybe not stack their team, but they really tried to bring on guys from other streams. But it's commendable for Illawarra that they created a club for the local juniors to move into. I don't know if long term that was the best strategy, but obviously very commendable for them to do that. Illawarra was one of my favourite teams growing up as a kid. I liked them pretty much every time, apart from when they played Parramatta. Always enjoyed to see them be successful. And, in this season, in this 1982 season, their success in the Midweek Cup was something that was very exciting for everyone to see. Did you have any other thoughts on the Illawarra, or did you want me just to move into the history of Panasonic Cup?
It was just a wonderful team and club, and just to know that you had that strong connection to the team. And as you mentioned, just the juniors that had come through. So obviously in the inception year of 1982, a lot of juniors that were playing at Sydney clubs at the time came back home, the likes of John Doherty, who was playing for Manly and for West. He came back to the Illawarra Steelers. John Sparks was playing for the Balmain Tigers. He came back home to the Illawarra Steelers. So it was a real coming home of a lot of players to be able to play for their local club, and it had always been like that, I guess, the whole way through. The Steelers in the Illawarra didn't have a lot of money. They had their major backer. First off, it was Kaiser Stuhl, the wine company, but then it became BHP, which is obviously the major industry here in the Illawarra as well. And that was their main backer. And outside of that, they didn't really have a big leagues club that could support them as well financially. So the Illawarra really relied on their juniors to prop up the team. And I guess any extra funds that the Illawarra club had, it went towards trying to entice some of these other players from other areas that might have been bigger names. Alan McIndoe, for one, I remember when they got him from Penrith. He was a Queensland representative, but they got him down as a winger as well. So, it always seemed to be a financial struggle for the Steelers the whole way through, and I guess this sort of blends in nicely with this Panasonic Cup.
Yeah, one thing that does stand out, Luke, from that game in terms of player talent, you mentioned a lot of Illawarra juniors, but the interesting ones are two names, Andy Gregory and Steve Hampston. Obviously, a lot of people know Andy Gregory, maybe at that time, maybe one of the top halfbacks in the world, might have been the top halfback in the world. I don't know, don't want to sort of comment on that, but definitely a well-known name and someone that they brought in. And Steve Hampson, he was a fullback from Wigan as well, as Ian Gregor was from Wigan as well. So it's interesting thing that they, although they did foster the junior talent, they did make some moves to bring in some talent from overseas. And I'm assuming that, I'd forgotten that Ian Gregor even played for Illawarra, actually. But, was it a sort of a good season? Did both those players, contribute well in 1989 for the Steelers?
Yeah, well, as I said, they found their way in the Illawarra. A number of English players had come over, and it was for a three-month period that all these English players were coming over. Joe Lydon, Martin Afire, I believe, as well. At the same time, headed across. And the Steelers were lucky enough to get those two players in, Steve Hampson at fullback and Andy Gregory. And at the time, Andy Gregory was the Great Britain half. So this was a huge get for the All-Ice Steelers, and it turned out that this Panasonic Cup final was actually the first game that these two players had played for the Illawarra Steelers. So it was a massive coup for the Steelers to be able to game these two players. I've tried to do a little bit of ringing around to find out how it actually came about, but a lot of people that are closely tied to the Illawarra Steelers don't know how they actually landed here in Wollongong and managed to become a part of the club, because the club certainly didn't have the money to pay for such big names. So that still today even remains a mystery.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I'm not sure what the story behind that is. I'd like to know if anyone does know what the story behind that is. But I think we might move on from the Illawarra now. We might talk about the Midweek Cup, the format that, you know, this Panasonic Cup is in. The Panasonic Cup, the 1989 one, is actually the last official midweek competition. They did go on and play for a few years more. I think it was a pre-season up to maybe about 91-92. This was the end of the official pre-season, the official midweek cups that they were playing. This cup competition started as the Amco Cup in 1974. And one of the interesting things about the Amco Cup of 1974 is the winner was actually Western Division. So I don't know if a lot of people remember these midweek cups, but you got a lot of different teams. You got a lot of the groups from representatives of Group 9, Group 12, whatever they were. You got a lot of things like Western Division. You got combined Brisbane in 1979, who made the final as well. Just generally different things like that. There was a South Island, New Zealand at one point. And it was a competition where you could have these kind of teams play against your New South Wales Rugby League team. But one of the interesting things about the whole sort of, talking about these groups and divisions is, apart from Western Division and this combined Brisbane in 1974, no other team who wasn't part of the New South Wales Rugby League at the time made a final, which is interesting in a way, and it may be part of the reason why they didn't continue with this competition. It's just another competition that between New South Wales Rugby League teams. Why bother sort of playing against combined Brisbane or any of these ones if they're not going to be competition?
You look at it now and you try and put this in a position of how rugby league is today, and there's no way on this earth that professional players are going to be playing on a Wednesday night. It's amazing to think that these guys, back in the day, they were part-timers. They were remember when it used to flash up the player profiles on the State Bank Big Game, and it was like Sellerman and garbage truck driver and things like that. And that was just the thing that it was. These players had jobs outside of rugby league, so they'd work all week. They train three nights a week, they play on a Saturday/Sunday, play Wednesday midweeks, and then back it up again the following weekend. It's just amazing to think that this is what the players did. But my thoughts back on this were, I remember attending some of the Panasonic Cup matches in the early piece as well, not only this final, but games earlier as well. And it was just funny that there was just such a big event on in the middle of the week on a Wednesday night. I remember travelling up to Leichhardt Oval to watch Balmain play in a Panasonic Cup game there on a Wednesday night. The lead-up games were always the Commonwealth Bank Cup. Remember with the high schools as well?
Yeah, so the high schools used to play, yeah.
Yeah, the Fairfield Pats and the St. Greg's of Campbelltown, and you'd see all these young players, and then eventually a few years down the track they were playing first grade. So it was an amazing night to think that, this was being played in the middle of a rugby league week. And, as I said, I just couldn't imagine something like this happening today. It'd be more lower tier players.
They couldn't do it now. The thing about this was, this is the time period when they were playing, all five or six games on a Sunday. Nighttime football, like a Friday night or a Monday night football, was a novelty. So part of the appeal of this competition was, you played under lights. It was the nighttime football, and it's a little bit like in the cricket when the 2020 came around, and it was a made for TV event. And when you look at the way that they ran this competition, they had them, like I said, playing in nighttime. They had four quarter football. They had extra time to put ads into things, and that's just the way that this competition was.
Absolutely right. Yeah, that's exactly what it was, wasn't it? It was a novelty because that's all we ever saw were daytime games, the Saturday 3 o'clock game on the ABC, and then the remainder went over to Sunday with just one of those being on TV, and yeah, they were all daytime games. So it was a huge novelty to see games under lights and the players running out with the boot polish under the eyes.
Yeah, I just remember that was fantastic when they did that, the black polish under the eyes and everything. The strange thing about this competition, which, you know, I never really realised until I looked back through the records, is particularly in this time in sort of 1989, is the way they used to decide who would get through to the final rounds. So every one of the New South Wales Rugby League teams, so the 16 teams, were involved, and even before 1988, when there were 13, they would have all the New South Wales Rugby League teams, and there would be some kind of pseudo playoff that would happen. So you get weird instances where, say, maybe, you know, a team representing a team from Perth would play representing a team from Adelaide in Perth, and then the winner would play, you know, a PNG representative team, and then that winner would, you know, get into the final 16. And, you know, like the quarterfinals and the final 16 for that competition, you know, was always had those teams. It's a little bit like how the Challenge Cup is run nowadays. But you know, obviously with the Challenge Cup, there's a lot more teams involved, and, you know, they kind of bring clubs in depending on the, you know, whether they're in, you know, the top division or the next division down, in kind of in an order to try and get your best teams in, not make them play, you know, the smaller teams. But this was more of, you know, in this particular year, it was more of, you know, a team plays, like I said, you know, Perth and the Adelaide and stuff like that, and then the winner somehow played St George. I don't know why. Maybe they were one of the teams that weren't as good the year before. I never looked into that, but yeah, just sort of a strange format of who gets to go through, and, you know, like they had so many different representatives, you know, these other, you know, the South Island, as I said before, New Zealand, and all the groups and things. But, you know, I always thought that, you know, it was great when you had like a New South Wales Rugby League team playing, you know, like a districts team or something like that. And I always looked forward to seeing these unusual kind of games. But yeah, maybe it's just my thought, but they seem to... I thought they happened more often than what they did, but in reality, they didn't happen very often. It was pretty much just the New South Wales teams playing each other.
No, it was. It was very strange. I'm trying to think back to, obviously, the Country Rugby League team that got put into the competition. I'm wondering if that came about from the team that won the CRL championships at the time. Obviously, the Group 6 of the 7s, the Illawarras, the Western Divisions, that they played their country championships. And I wonder if it was a case of whoever won the country championships that got you the entry into this competition.
Well, for 1989, which is the last year of the Panasonic Cup, they had a strange format where combined Brisbane, so you still had the Broncos, obviously, you know, we're going to talk about them later, but you had a combined Brisbane team playing Port Moresby, and then the winner of that game, which was combined Brisbane, having to play New South Wales Country, which they also won. Then they had to play St George, and, you know, they lost to St George, and the team, obviously, you know, the loss to St George meant St George went into the round of 16, and then they just joined the other 15 New South Wales Rugby League teams, which is very strange. You know, you had this three-way playoff kind of thing to find the last spot. But, you know, in other years, you had teams, you know, normal New South Wales Rugby League teams playing against, you know, Northern Districts and groups things. And they were, like you said, you know, they were playing against, you know, Country Rugby League and all these other things that they were playing against. And, you know, they'd lost on some occasions as well. So it was interesting to see those games. But by the time you came around to the 1989 Panasonic Cup, you had this, like I said, like a weird three-way playoff to decide the last spot. And pretty much after that, it was just the 16 in New South Wales Rugby League teams playing against each other. Yeah, and like I said, you know, in some of the previous seasons, you know, there was some teams that you know, lost to some of these lower, you know, division teams, and then, you know, in some of the instances too, you find some of the teams that aren't doing so well in the New South Wales Rugby League going a lot better in this Panasonic Cup, and it, you know, maybe that was them just trying to see if they could win something, because, you know, they weren't going to win the main premiership. So, you know, was there a chance that they could win this and put a bit more into it? Some of the better teams resting their players and, you know, getting knocked out in earlier stages. And, it, you know, maybe that was part of the
the intrigue of this competition is was, you know, your team may not be going so well in the main competition, but they, you know, they could maybe do something better, maybe do a bit of like a cup run, as they talk about it in the English game. But, you know, I always found it really interesting watching some of these unusual places playing, you know, not unusual places, but, you know, not the same teams you see playing all the time. What did you think about sort of, you know, Illawarra's, you know, chances in 1989?
But, yeah, agreed. And it's funny too now that you say that about the clubs and being in it and not looking at the main competition but coming into this. Like the Steelers in this season of 1989, they were poor. They were so bad. They, I think what they lost 10 of their 11 games leading into this final in the regular competition, but all of a sudden they found themselves in a final against probably one of the greatest teams that were playing in that competition that year in the Brisbane Broncos. So it was funny that, that they got themselves up for these midweek games and got themselves through to a final, but unfortunately weren't performing in the Winfield Cup competition. As I said, lost 10 of the 11 games before that final.
Yeah, look, on the way to the finals, in the round of 16, Illawarra defeated West 12-0 and Brisbane beat Canberra 18-13. And then in the quarterfinals, Illawarra absolutely smashes Cronulla 40-0. That must have been a great game to watch, Luke.
Yeah, and it was. And yeah, that's one I remember where Brett Rodwell from Holy Spirit, he's starting this. This was one of his first grade games for the Illawarra Steelers. And he came out with the headgear on, the now famous headgear that he wore. And I think he scored 3 tries in that one too. He was fantastic playing out in the centres.
Yeah, and at the same point, Brisbane absolutely smashes Parramatta 42-6, unfortunately. And then we move on to the semi-finals. And the semi-final is a bit of a strange one for Illawarra. They play North Sydney. It's 12-all draw, and they actually win on a countback. I remember the countbacks. Do you remember the countbacks?
So strange. So
It was. It was funny. And I guess going into this game too, as a Steelers fan, we were always nervous playing the Bears because the Steelers went back to the white jersey. And it seemed like the Steelers had no luck when they played in the white jersey whenever they played the North Sydney Bears in the red. But anyway, this one finished up 12-all in the semi-final. Mm. But the countback rules in this Panasonic Cup final at the time were whoever scored the most tries won. Well, the tries were even. So then it went back to penalties. And the Steelers won the penalty count in this game. Mm. So they progressed through to the final. So really, they only just scraped in off the back of being a more disciplined side than the North Sydney Bears.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing because when you get to the final, you know, it's a close final towards the end, and they mentioned the countbacks again, and yeah, I find it strange that, you know, you can make a final, you know, you even could even win a final just based on, you know, how many penalties you concede against an opposition. You know, it's just a strange way of determining a winner.
Yeah, it is, and it's more like soccer. You see a lot of soccer competitions that, and they get into a final stage that, if it's tied up nil all and they go to penalty shootout and nothing happens and they go back to penalty. So it was very strange for rugby league to take on that rule.
Yeah, and just to finish off, so Brisbane then pretty easily defeats South Sydney 24-4 to make their way through. So if you go back and have a look at the Panasonic Cup for how Brisbane gets to the final, you know, they're two very comprehensive victories, and then, you know, one maybe not as comprehensive, but the team they beat is the eventual premiers of 1989. So you got to say, you know, red hot team, and in this competition, definitely, you know, the favourites. What's your feelings about, you know, the week leading up to it in up to this competition in 1989, up to the final? I mean, obviously, 13 years old, so you're probably thinking, you know, your team's definitely going to win. You have probably out of the confidence, but you know, what was, how confident were you that they were going to get the victory?
I think it was just the excitement of it all, that the Steelers were playing in such a big thing. It was the final of the Panasonic Cup, and it was the chance of the Steelers to win their first bit of silverware as well. So I guess as supporters, we went there confident that maybe the Steelers could pull an upset against this Broncos team. And I remember as a kid as well, whenever you went to Wollongong Showground and the Brisbane Broncos played there, it was like they were movie stars when they turned up. They were just this phenomenon of Gene Miles and Wally Lewis and Alan Langer and all these famous guys that you always saw on the big stage for State of Origin. And they were playing against your team who were just locals. from the local area. It was like, as a fan, you had stars in your eyes looking at these big name players, and you can only imagine how it felt for these younger players coming in that were in this Steelers side. Like, Rod Wishart was only 20 at the time, and Brett Rodwell, I think, was 18 at the time. So these are such young kids coming in and playing superstars. So from a Steelers playing perspective, you think, geez, they might have thought they were in for a tough night, but they certainly brought some toughness into this game, especially defensively too.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting you mentioned the ages. You know, I think at some point, you know, in the commentary, Rex Mossop gets a run sheet and tells us at least 20 times that Rodwell's, you know, 19 years of age. You know, he said 18, but I think, you know, maybe he had 19 on his sheet, so obviously he kept going with that. I think it's time to, at this point, maybe get into the game. So I'd never really heard of Shane Duffy before from Brisbane, but I think he had an excellent game. But, you know, looking at that Brisbane side, so you've got, you know, you've got Gene Miles, you've got Sam Bacco, you know, you've got Lewis and Langer, you know, you've got Peter Jackson, you've got Hancock, you know, you've got all kinds of, you know, pretty much most of the Queensland Origin team, you know, coming up against, you know, like we said, like Rodwell, very young, Wishart, you know, Jeff Hardy's there. You know, we mentioned Andy Gregory and Steve Hampson before, you know, had a little bit of experience, and you had Tony Smith there as well. But, you know, quite a lot of guys with inexperience. And, you know, they did look in that game a little bit overawed just early on. I mean, you know, they did kind of muscle up fairly early, but then after that looked fairly overawed. And then, you know, before you can realise it, it's, you know, it's quarter time and, you know, they're down sort of 16-0. You know, I'd like to know what it was like to be there at the ground, because, you know, it would feel like in a situation like that, the crowd might be quite hushed and quiet. What was it like to be there?
Yeah, it didn't go quite once. Like, and that's one of my strongest recollections of the game, was just how loud the crowd was, and it just didn't stop the whole way through. So I guess sort of going back, and something that I want to touch on later, was the actual prize purse as well. It was $175,000 going to the winner. Mm-hmm. So this was a big thing, again, for such a small club like the Steelers. But going back to the atmosphere around the game, and I remember when they read out the team list and Wally Lewis's name got mentioned and the boos went up and the old Wally is a such and such chant went up, and there was the anthem and the fireworks and the smoke was just everywhere. And then all of a sudden the game starts, and I thought the Steelers were great in defence at the start, and then it was a 5-metre penalty against them, and then there was a hold-down penalty, which, now looking at it on review and having referee eyes on it now, it didn't seem like a standout slow play-the-ball penalty. Yeah. And the Broncos have gone penalty, all of a sudden they've scored their first try through Joe Kilroy out wide, and they're up 6-0, and then all of a sudden, the momentum again, it's with the Broncos, and as you said, they kicked out to a big there. As it was, yeah, you said, it's played in quarters, and they were up 16-0 after the first quarter. Joe Kilroy had scored, Peter Jackson had scored.
Yeah, and Sam Bacco's try where he pushes over, and I think Rex Mossop wanted to have a real go at that one. He just kept going on about it, you know, being a former, you know, representative forward, and, you know, he kept going on about, oh, look, you know, Coach Ron Hildreth won't be very happy with the Illawarra forwards for letting him get through there. I, you know, the sort of guy that Rex Mossop is, and he just, he just really, he couldn't handle it. But look, I think this point's where you've got to give Illawarra a bit of credit, because, you know, you're down 16-0, red hot Broncos team. It'd be easy just to give up and just, you know, give up a big score here, and, you know, they feel like maybe the game's getting away from them. But, you know, this is the point where they really dig in, and, you know, slowly but slowly they turn the momentum in this game, and, you know, this game turns from being a, you know, 16-0 at quarter time to coming back to, you know, like a 16-14 by half time. You know, I didn't say they didn't just instantly turn it around, but, you know, it was real grit and real courage for them to come back into it.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? They worked really hard for each other, and I just loved that in that game, there was no structure to it. Like Jeff Hardy, who you mentioned before, like he was taking hit ups off the play the ball. He was taking a lot of the returns off the kickoffs as well. Like he was so strong, but I thought the balance of the game swung as well. So those early penalties that went to the Broncos, they then went to the Steelers, and we saw back-to-back penalties for the Steelers where Brisbane got penalised for Shepherd, then they copped the 5-metre penalty, and then the Steelers got a repeat set from a goal line dropout. And this is when things turned, and Andy Gregory, the British halfback, playing for the Steelers in his first game, put a beautiful little grubber in, and Joe Kilroy couldn't pick it up, and Brett Rubble scored to get the Steelers their first try, and I still remember the noise when that went up. I was sitting in the eastern side of Parramatta Stadium, up on the second tier, and I was with my mum and dad, my brothers, my sister, and also my grandmother. My nana came to this match as well, and I can still remember looking at her. Look, at the time, she might have been 60, oh no, she would have been about 70 years of age. She was standing on her seat, cheering and yelling and clapping, like she was just that invested in the game like everyone else. When Brett Russell scored, it was just amazing. The noise that went up and the loudness of the crowd, it was just huge. And this was the start of the Steelers' revival.
Yeah, and like you said, the crowd's a big part of this. It's, you know, from early on, you know, we're talking about the early part of the match, they're singing and, you know, they're enjoying themselves. And then, you know, obviously you tell me, you know, they didn't sort of let up beyond that point. But, you know, as El Ross start to come into this game again and they start to, you know, they have that try, they start to score points, you can just hear the crowd noise. And, you know, I think at this point it'd be great, you know, if you haven't already watched this, you know, I'd recommend you go on YouTube and have a look at the 1989 Panasonic Cup Grand Final, Panasonic Cup Final. But make sure you watch the Channel 10 version, not the Brisbane version, as you sort of said to me this discussion, Luke. You know, maybe a little less bias in the Channel 10 coverage. But they mention it, you know, on a few occasions, how loud this crowd really is. And, you know, it was just, you could just feel the intensity. Even watching it, you know, years later on a YouTube clip, you can feel the intensity of the crowd noise.
No, it just did not let up. And I've got a good memory, but I just can't remember. I surely had to have had the next day or two off school, like the sore throats from yelling and carrying on. I remember it was just an amazing place to be. But then, yeah, we kicked it off in place to the sideline as well to make it 16-6. And, it brought the crowd into the game even more, and that momentum as well, because the Steelers were next to score.
Yeah, so they score again. They score another try and convert. Then they get that... they get that penalty, right before the halftime break.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so it was that famous intercept that Jeff Hardy took, and it's played on all the highlight reels for, excuse me, forever and a day. And in the commentary, and they said they think Illawarra has just exploded as Jeff Hardy took off over half the way and then turned it back inside for Rod Wishart for Wishy to score underneath the post and make it 16-12 just before half time. And that was the thing that the Steelers, well, guess what, they might be able to do this now. They've got themselves back into the game and given themselves a chance.
I found it really interesting how Rex Mossop pronounces Rod Wishart's name. He calls him Wishart.
Yes, wasn't it funny?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what was happening with that. I kept thinking to myself, have I been saying this guy's name wrong all these years? Or is it just Rex Mossop? It just thinks, oh, it's pronounced Wishart. It makes me think of the old 12th man have a go at Rabs when they do the Renouf, nice run Renouf kind of thing. They keep changing his name. And I think I just realised when we were just talking before, when I said that penalty goal, that's in the third quarter, isn't it? Because it is 16-12 at halftime.
Yeah, 16-12 halftime.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you go from 16-0 at quarter time to 16-12 at halftime. It must have been very interesting at the time. I mean, I watched it back, and, you know, if I didn't realise what the actual end score was, I would have thought, look, Illawarra is going to run away with this. You know, they've come all the way back in one half. They've turned the whole momentum and everything's going their way. And then it's a strange kind of third quarter. There's only, you know, there's that one score, that penalty that happens, you know, right at the very end of that half.
this is the point where, you know, we gave praise to Illawarra earlier, but I think this is the point where you've got to give praise to the Broncos' defence. You know, in it's pretty much that's all Illawarra that third period, and they just keep repelling them. You know, their defence, their goal line defence, their grit, they just don't let Illawarra get that score to get in front. And, you know, it's very good defence. It's not something that, you know, I sort of associate with the Broncos, but especially in that period. But, you know, could you imagine the Broncos of this period? If they had defence like that, you know, they'd be doing a lot better than what they have been doing recently.
Yes. So, yeah, and you can see why a lot of the old boys from the Broncos are doing so much agitating up north at the moment as well. But, yeah, they obviously had a real strong character of their work in defence, and when their team currently at the moment isn't doing that, then I guess that's why the old boys are sort of blowing up a little bit too up there in Brisbane.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I was very impressed, you know, with the defence Broncos had in the third period, even in the fourth period to a point. You know, it looked like pretty much the whole of that third quarter there, the whole 20 minutes they were on the Brisbane's line. You know, that wasn't the case, but it just felt that way. It felt like they were pushing the line, and you know, then you get to just before the quarter time break and you get the penalty, and obviously, you know, you're gonna have to make a decision there, and they, you know, quite rightly take the 2 points and go 16-14, and then, you know, it comes out into the fourth quarter, and you know, they're still pushing the line. They're, you know, it still looks like it's just a matter of time before they find that one try that gets them on top, and then once that happens, maybe the floodgates open. And but, you know, Brisbane, to their credit, don't let them through. And then I'm not going to say it's lack of composure. It might be just, you know, some of the younger players being in that team, but it looks like they get to the fourth quarter, and, you know, some of the passes get pushed a little bit. They're not kind of, you know, they're losing a bit of that composure in a way, and you know, they just sort of start making a few little errors, and then basically what happens is we get to the event, you know, how you sort of pitched it to me, where you said it was the largest forward pass in the history of all recorded rugby league. I think you might have said to me something very similar to that, Luke. It was I watched it live, and I, you know, as I was watching it, thinking, well, you know, maybe a little bit forward, but I wasn't kind of throwing arms up or anything like that. But you know, obviously, you've looked at it, and you know, it is. I think it is a forward pass, but maybe only just. Being at the ground at the time, what was it? Was it like? Was it you know, was it just disappointment that the Broncos scored, or was it the fact that, you know, everyone was up in arms about this pass going so far forward?
Yep, it was like the old days of Cumberland, and they were going to tear the green stand down, the Illawarra Steelers stand. They just went berserk. Yeah, it was a bit of a lobbed basketball pass by Peter Jackson over the top for Dream Miles to score. And, and to this day, I can still see it. It was forward then. I've watched it back on replay now. It's got to be forward now. Mm. And if my now friend Graham Annesley could have blown it up, at that point then obviously the Broncos don't score, and I guess the Steelers are in with a chance of winning it. But unfortunately, history shows that, Terry Madison played a beautiful short ball for Peter Jackson to lob that forward pass over the top of Gene Miles, who scores, and all of a sudden it's 22-14. And Coach Ron Yildiz at the time too started making a lot of replacements, because the Steelers had just done so much work defensively. I thought Michael Carberry, he was really strong in defence. He was replaced by Cavill Hugh. Mm-hmm. And then we also saw Dean Hanson come off. He was replaced by Michael Bolt. Dean Hanson, the Adapto Canary, replaced by another local in Michael Bolt as well. So at this stage, we saw a few changes getting made as well by Coach Ron Hillitz to the Steelers team. So I guess this sort of, as a thing, we thought, well, maybe this might be just the last throw of the dice for the coach here, and he's just going to throw some players on and see what they can come up with.
Yeah, they did. I think they put four players on, whereas the Broncos make one change in the entire game. They have James Donnelly comes on and replaces Sam Backer. I think that's really early on too, like in maybe the second quarter or something like that. But yeah, like you said, Cavill Hugh comes on, Craig Keane, Michael Bolt, Trevor Kissel, and you know, you let me know that's for Tony Smith. But yeah, they make a few changes. They bring a few younger sort of guys in there. just give them a little bit more, you know, maybe a little bit more energy just towards the end of the game. And yeah, it works for them because, you know, they do look like they're finishing the stronger in this game. Then they get to this period, you've got maybe, I think it's about maybe 2-3 minutes left, and then they bomb a chance. Like, they've a good chance of scoring, and they, you know, they drop the ball, and it goes to a scrum, and then, you know, good old scrum win against the feed. So they get the ball back, which is it's the second win against the feed in the whole game. Brisbane gets one earlier on. And then, you know, they set themselves up, and finally Steve Hampson scores and brings it back to 22-20.
Yep, absolutely fantastic. And it was the replacement, Michael Bolt, who comes on at hooker, goes into his first scrum, and he wins one against the feet and against the head. And, yeah, then we saw the ball shift Steve Hansen. He went to the line with the ball in both hands, and then he just slipped between those two defenders and scored out wide. And again, it was the dream's back on. The Steelers could do this.
Yeah.
They're back in the game with 2 minutes to go. They might be able to jag this. Obviously waiting for Whiffy to take his conversion from the sideline, but it just gave us all hope. And again, the place just went up, and then it was the Steelers' chance. And even to this day, tingles now talking about it. I remember the Steelers' chant and how loud it was and for how long it went. And I can't remember, it may have even been while Whiffy was trying to convert the goal that the noise was still happening. Like, no one stopped. Just the momentum was with the Steelers players, and it went over the fence to the crowd as well. The fans were certainly running with it as well.
Yeah, and like you said, there wasn't one left to get that result. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, if the game can be 82 minutes long, you know, that might have been what it needed. Yeah, I've gone through this myself. You know, I'm supporter of a team that was down in a grand final 24-0 at half time, and, you know, came back to, you know, 6 points at the end, and, you know, they just run out of time at the end. And, you know, sometimes you feel like, oh, if they just had that extra couple of minutes, if this was an 82 minute game, you know, do they win this game? But then, you know, sometimes you watch your team and you go, geez, I wish this was 75 minutes because they're failing at the end, and you're trying to ride them home, and they're falling apart at the end. You know, it was one of those things. Like, Brisbane doesn't get that try, you know, from that pass. You know, is it Illawarra who gets this try and, you know, goes on with it? And, you know, obviously, you know, Brisbane not scoring means that Illawarra's back in front. You know, is that how they could win this game? You know, if they score a little bit earlier rather than when they score with less than, you know, a couple of minutes to go. You know, at the end, they really are throwing everything they can at Brisbane. And it just feels like, you know, just like one more line break. Yeah, it's all they've been needed. Maybe just one line break, and they'll race away and they'll score and they'll win this game. But, you know, just not to be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's it now, having the chance now to watch it back on YouTube and to see it. And I just thought the spark that Trevor Kissel and Michael Bolt sort of gave when they came on, those fresh legs, it made a massive difference. And if the Steelers, as you said, have another minute, another 2 minutes from what they did, it's a massive chance they go on and win this. So there's probably a few things within this game that if it had been different, the Steelers go on and win this, but unfortunately lose 22-20 and don't get that $175,000 winner's check.
Yeah, I always love the winner's checks for these things. Yeah, you know, like $175,000 for the winner of the game and things like that. It makes me think of, remember as well. I've got a couple of things on the commentary, but this is one of them. So at the halftime break, they had Graham Hughes talking and doing an announcement of the top six tries from the Panasonic Cup. So it wasn't the New South Wales competition, it was the Panasonic Cup. And, you know, they're counting from number six down to number one. And, you know, you're going, oh, yeah, they're all pretty good tries and stuff like that. So they do number six down to number two. And then they go, we'll come back after the break and announce the winner. Anyway, they show the winner, and it's a Manly try. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good try and everything. And that looks, yeah, pretty interesting. And then they go, oh, and we've... The experts have looked at this and they've determined that the whoever it is, X and Y player, I can't remember who the person is, was most instrumental in that try, and so he wins the all expenses, you know, trip for two to Cairns at some luxury resort to, you know, to basically that's his prize. I'm like, hold on, you're giving away prizes? Like,
this is a professional competition. Why are they getting prizes? It was like, you know, it's like being on a game show or something. And it made me always think of the, you know, back in the old days when, you know, you'd have your $1,000 player of the match kind of thing. And you don't realize, you know, how far we've come in terms of professionalism. Like, you know, man of the match players don't have the little man of the match check anymore. And you don't have like a guy winning try of the year, winning a, you know, some kind of all expenses paid trip to whatever hotel that was.
Yeah, and it was a brand new hotel in Cairns, wasn't it?
There you go. Yeah, it was so hilarious because they're saying things like, oh, you know, you can go in the off season and work on his body in the gym and all that sort of stuff. And the other one that I found really weird is at halftime, Graham Hughes is interviewing the quarterback for the LA Raiders. So obviously, yeah, came over for a promotion to try and promote the NFL. And I just found it, maybe it's just a thing with Australians and Americans, but I've just found it like the cringiest thing I've ever seen. Like, it's, you know, he's talking to him, and this guy's just, you know, he's there basically just to promote the NFL. He doesn't really care. But yeah, Graham Hughes is there going and asking him things like, oh, look, you know, what position would you play if you were playing this? And, you know, what do you think of the game? And the guy's like, oh, yeah, you know, the typical thing they always tell them to say, oh, look, oh, they're so tough. They play without pads and all that sort of garbage and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then, and this guy just wanted to get through it. All he wanted to do was say, hey, I want to tell you about this thing that I'm here for. But, you know, Graham Hughes is talking about things like, oh, well, if they played this sport in America, would you be playing it? And he's like, well, if I grew up playing it, then I would, you know, this sort of stuff. He just wanted to get out of there. And you could tell by the way he was answering these questions, it was, please ask me the set questions I've given you to ask. I'll answer them and then I can get out of here and I don't have to be here anymore.
That's exactly how it was. He turned the interview on its head that, Graham Hughes was going down a particular line. He's like, nah, I just need to talk about what I'm here for. I'll talk to what I need to do and I'm out of here.
Exactly, and it was so awkward. It was so cringy.
Wasn't it very awkward?
Oh my God, what is this and why are we doing this? It was like everything in the production was extremely 80s. I mean, you had, every time you went to an ad break, you had the, you know, the 80s rock music playing you out to the ad break, and, you know, they had the cheerleaders.
And there was 1,000 of them.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like there was one every 5 meters, like in a 5 meter grid, and it kind of looked like military precision, you know, like one of the like the Chinese military doing a precision walk or something like that, you know, where they're marching all together.
Absolutely, it was. It was very weird.
Oh, I just thought I'd mention those. There's a few things I watched, and I just wanted to talk to someone about it, you know, because obviously, you know, you watched it today as well. And I just need to share this. The crazy things that happen in sometimes in rugby league coverage, and some of the things that they do. Anyway, getting back on the game, we have to find a way to for Illawarra to win this game. So, look, I don't really want to harp on a forward pass. I, you know, like I'm on a podcast with a former NRL referee. I don't want us to do anything like that. So, I think that maybe what we can say for this one is maybe Coach Ron Hilditch, he puts those replacements on 2 minutes earlier, and you know the extra enthusiasm of those guys coming on, you know, turns the game a little bit more Illawarra's favour, and you know they score, you know, before that try for Brisbane happens. You know, they had a few opportunities, maybe just that little bit of enthusiasm gets them over the line, and then Brisbane don't score again, so they end up winning 20-6. Because, you know, I don't want to sort of finish this off and make this sort of like a ref's fault.
No, not at all. And you're right. It could have been that a different thought while coaching for Ron Hilditch was to bring these players on earlier, because the Steelers did a truckload of work in defence, and obviously they would have been some tired legs and some tired bodies, because as I said before, they played on a Sunday before this against, I think it was against the Tigers, because Wayne Pearce in commentary had mentioned that he played the Steelers team only a few days beforehand. So you've got a team, and as we saw from the coverage, the field was an absolute bog. They're not the fields that we see today. They're absolutely pristine and look like bowling greens. Like, this was a bog through the middle. It was plenty of mud, and I dare say the game that the Steelers team played the Tigers on the weekend at Leichhardt Oval was probably the same as well. So you've got come from being leg-heavy playing on the weekend, they've gone to their trade or they've gone to their job the next couple of days, and they're turning up on Wednesday night to play in a game like this, maybe that's the case, that if Kotaron Hilditch brings on these replacements earlier, then that provides that spark that the Steelers can run with the momentum of the crowd that was behind them, and they come away and they win this. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be.
Yeah, and I even found it interesting. So they say in the commentary that Brisbane actually plays three games in 6 days. And it's, you know, it might be something to do with the fact that when they do the semi-finals for this, the Illawarra Steelers play 1 week and then the Brisbane play the following week. So, you know, I think that there's quite a lot of games in a short period of time. And like you said, you know, it's a boggy conditions, heavy underfoot. They've only made one replacement in the whole game. You know, the tired legs. And like you said, if you put some fresh legs on there, you know, a little bit earlier, maybe that's all it takes to sort of get Illawarra back on top. And, you know, maybe that's the sort of thing that happens. And, you know, maybe Brisbane have that ball, but they don't make that break and Illawarra get it back. And, you know, they go and score at the other end and it's 20-16. And, you know, like it I think in a way that kind of makes this an even more exciting game. I know, you know, like it's a pretty exciting game and everything like that. But I think that this game suffers from a little bit of the, you know, the favourites win. You know, the underdog story doesn't sort of come about. You know, if it's this is probably a sensational game. You know, if it's a 16-0 after quarter time, and the other team, the underdog, you know, the good guys come back and win it. You know, 20-16, the bad guys don't score again. Not that I say Brisbane are bad guys. I apologise to any Brisbane fans I still have out there, probably none, because I don't tend to do anything nice for you guys. But look, it's, you know, like it from the perspective of what you watch this and the way that the crowd was and everything like that, you know, the Broncos were definitely, you know, the favourites and the ones that, you know, people, the neutrals wouldn't have been rooting for on this one. So, you know, if Illawarra can get a famous victory like this, they can come back, they can score 20 unanswered points and win 20-16. You know, I think this game gets a little bit more credence and probably a little bit more recognition, and like which it really does deserve, because it's a fantastic game of football.
Yeah, and this is the funny thing, because the flow on from this game is that it was like the Illawarra Steelers won. So what happens at full time, I guess, to try and finish off the game, from my perspective as a fan, I remember when Wally went up and he held the cup up and the boos continued again, and then it was just a Steelers chant broke out over the ground, like the Steelers had won the game. Yeah. And it was just this non-stop Steelers chant that kept going and going. So from there, so obviously Brisbane win their first bit of silverware, they go home to Brisbane. But for the Illawarra, everyone goes back home and they go to Town Hall in Wollongong and they have a celebration for the players. The Town Hall is packed, that they couldn't fit any more in there. So having spoken to some of the Illawarra administrators during the week, knowing that I was coming on the show and trying to get some stuff from them as well, the Town Hall holds about 1,500 to 2,000 people. Well, it was jam-packed shoulder to shoulder. They had trouble trying to even fit the players through to present them to the crowd, and there was still an overflow outside the Town Hall onto the main street, Crown Street of Wollongong as well. But it was like they won the Winfield Cup, but they've actually gone and lost a midweek competition. So for the Illawarra, it was like they won the game. It was amazing, and allegedly celebrations for the players continued until the break of dawn the next day. So it was a big celebration, and they could obviously go back to work and back it up with a Winfield Cup premiership game a few days later. So from an Illawarra perspective, it was like they'd won the thing.
Yeah, and I can imagine if they did actually win the thing. I think that's where we go next. You know, if Illawarra does win this Panasonic Cup, what sort of happens beyond that? Just on the Panasonic Cup itself, I found it sort of interesting. In the post match, they were interviewing Wally Lewis, and you know, of course, the crowd's still booing him, and he's saying things like, "Oh, look, you know, the Illawarra fans aren't real happy right now, but when we get back to Brisbane, there'll be a whole bunch of, you know, Brisbane fans will be incredibly happy for this and that sort of stuff." You know, that was Brisbane's first ever title, but you know, I feel like, I mean, I'm obviously not a Brisbane fan, I wasn't there around at the time, but I feel like most people expected that
you know, the way Brisbane were and the sort of club they were, that this wasn't going to be the last thing they ever won. But I think, you know, for Illawarra fans, this was their big chance to win something. You know, like, I don't think they, looking forward, were going, oh, we're almost premierships, you know, what's it, premiership time and stuff like that. You know, this is something legitimate that we can win. You know, I think maybe the Brisbane fans wouldn't have cared too much if they won a, you know, the Panasonic Cup or not. You know, it was sort of a different feeling having Brisbane win it. And, you know, maybe that's part of the problem with the Panasonic Cup and why it sort of finished. So this is, like I said, this is the last Panasonic Cup, 1989. They go on to do the Tuis Challenge. So they do the pre-season sort of Challenge Cup where it's just the 16 New South Wales Rugby League teams. And, you know, it doesn't last long. It only lasts a couple of years or so and then sort of just fades into obscurity. But, you know, the sort of the magic of the Panasonic Cup and, you know, right back to the Amco Cup is well and truly gone by this point. And, you know, it's maybe this extends its time a little bit, but, you know, I'm not sure whether that would be the case.
Yeah, I think so. And not only that, I guess, but, yeah, as they mentioned in the commentary, it was like State of Origin, this match. It was New South Wales, the Illawarra Steelers, versus Queensland, the Brisbane Broncos. So all of New South Wales in the New South Wales Rugby League competition were supporting the Steelers. So, yeah, maybe if the Steelers win this, that competition might have grown legs and gone into the following year. But, yeah, following that, it becomes a pre-season competition. But for mine, like, if we are to flip this result on its head and say, yes, the Steelers win it, as a hypothetical, then I look at what that money does to the Illawarra Steelers going forward, this $175,000, because we'll look back in time, and a first-grade contract back in 1989-1990, an average first-grade contract was around $30,000 a year, plus match payments to win losses. So $175,000 to the Steelers, when you're paying players $30,000, they could have gone to market following this the next year and kind of bought a few more big name players to bring into the club to help with experience around some of these juniors,
yeah,
to help
definitely
grow the club. And who knows what happens down the track. Maybe the Steelers get themselves a Winfield Cup premiership, and maybe the Steelers are still here with more corporate backing and yeah, are still in the competition as well. So who knows, things may have been a little bit different had this result of the Panasonic Cup gone the way of the Steelers.
Yeah, look, definitely that's where we're heading with this. You know, like we talk about the Illawarra Steelers and beyond this point. So as you said, like 89, not a great season. 90, 91, you know, sort of getting better, but, you know, still not there. But, you know, then 1992 comes around and, you know, the Illawarra Steelers are in the finals. And, you know, like that's their first finals, isn't it?
Yes. And that was massive in itself. I mean, the local paper down here, the Illawarra Mercury, they were running headlines of alive in the five because the Steelers had finally made the top five of the competition. That was the number that they took into semi-finals at the time. So it was very exciting. That was the first final series for the Steelers then in 92.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know whether this $175,000 makes a huge difference, but like as you said, you know, with the average salaries and stuff in that time, you know, doing the interim between 89 and 92, you know, they go out to market, they buy, you know, a couple more experienced players, they retain some, you know, young juniors, or you know, basically this team becomes just that little bit stronger than they were. Because, like, you know, they get into that final series, they get into a, you know, a game against, well, they win their first game, and then they get into a game against the Broncos, which, you know, the winner is going straight to the grand final. And, you know, what's to say the memories and the scars of 1989 don't come back and haunt the Broncos? You know, that they are worried about the fact that they're going to, you know, they're coming against this team that beat them in a big game, you know, a few years earlier. And, you know, Who's to say that maybe they don't get Andy Gregory to come back and do a little cameo at the end of the season, and you know, they win that game, and all of a sudden, you know, Illawarra is in a grand final. You know,
yeah, and I even to look to the even to the following season of 1990, like the Steelers finished ninth, so they've gone from finishing last to finishing ninth, and they're not that far outside of of making the finals. They won 11 and lost 10 with a draw, but the team that wins it in 1990 is the Canberra Raiders.
Yeah.
They're a team full of locals as well, but they have brought in some experience with some big-name Queenslanders like Mal Meninga and Steve Walters, an international in Brent Todd, a Queenslander in Gary Coyne. Like, they brought in some non-locals with a little bit of money to help bolster these juniors. So maybe the Steelers, if they win that extra money in 1989, they can go to market and find some of those good players to bring in, and maybe it could have been the Illawarra Steelers in 1990 as well, rather than the Canberra Raiders.
That's true. Like you said, you know, they bring that little bit of experience. They win a few more games. And then, obviously, winning more games bring more fans. They get better players. It's all kind of like a snowball effect. And, you know, what's to say that they don't, you know, continue to do that for a period of time, and, you know, they do get that premiership. Maybe not 92, I don't know. But, you know, it's definite that it's something that could have happened. I mean, you look at the period, this period especially in New South Wales Rugby League, so between sort of mid-80s to, we're up to 1995 in the Super League, when that sort of happens, there's the sort of haves and have-nots. And, you know, when you look at that, you've got some of these teams like your Broncos and your Raiders and stuff like that, who are the definite haves, and, you know, some of these other have-nots. And, you know, when it gets around to the Super League time, the haves are the ones that, you know, want to propose this new competition because they have everything, as I said. And, you know, the ones that are the have-nots don't really want to overextend themselves because they just don't have the money. And, you know, what's to say that Illawarra winning $175,000 in 1989 doesn't sort of catapult them to, you know, having a better, you know, more money because they win more games, they get more people through the gates, they sell more merchandise, they win more games. You know, it's a whole snowballing effect. And, you know, I don't know whether, I mean, obviously Canberra has a policy from the early 80s to bring in these guys from Queensland and everything. You know, it might be just the case that Illawarra didn't have the money to do that. You know, I don't know the politics of Illawarra Steelers, but, you know, if they've got that money, who's to say that they're not the one who's, you know, pushing for expansion of the competition, and, you know, they're not the ones on the front foot. And on the field, who's to say they're not, you know, the ones who are at the top of the table and, you know, they finally get that premiership?
Certainly does.
And then,
this is what we're all about, but the what ifs of, you know, Illawarra winning a premiership, you know, it makes it a whole lot harder for them to be assessed in the way they are when the criteria comes around. And look at, you know, if Illawarra is a premiership threat and one of the better teams, you know, Super League's probably knocking on the door and throwing money at them when, you know, they sort of maybe in reality didn't do that. You know, that could be what, you know, where they go.
Because, you know, at that point,
in a position of strength. Yeah, you're right.
You know what I mean? And maybe we're talking about the Illawarra Dragons instead of the St George Illawarra Dragons, or, you know, maybe we're talking about Illawarra playing a game against the St George Sharks or the Sutherland St George Sharks or whatever the hell happens, because those two have to merge because, you know, Illawarra is the powerful club in the area and they don't have to do the merger. So, you know, it gets us into that merger territory. I've already done the NRL national mergers, you know, last year. I don't want to go back there. But, you know, definitely puts Illawarra in a much more, a much stronger position, as you said. And, you know, maybe we have a standalone Illawarra club as the Illawarra Steelers in the NRL today. So look, I think that's all we really need to do. That gets us to the end. I want to thank you very much for joining me, Luke. And did you have any final comments?
Yeah, no, mate, it's just been fantastic to be able to come on and, yeah, talk about my beloved Illawarra Steelers. And I know a lot of other people here in Illawarra as well. Once they find out about this little chat, it'll certainly bring up some memories, and I'm sure it'll get everyone back on YouTube again and watching this game over and thinking about the what ifs and the hypothetical if, the Steelers win this game where they may well be today in 2021. But no, mate, it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed chatting to you and, talking all things Steelers and the Panasonic Cup in the 80s. And, it was certainly a very interesting time for rugby league.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. And like I said, I'm always happy to chat Illawarra and all things Illawarra Steelers. you know, I said before, and you know, I mean, when I was a kid, one of the teams I loved watching, you know, one of my favourites, and you know, it was really great to chat about Illawarra and the Panasonic Cup. Look, I kind of, you know, like I said, I know, you know, I know you and Al, and I know a few other Illawarra fans. There's obviously, you know, quite a few still Illawarra fans around, and you know, I know it's only a little thing, but every time I talk about that Dragons team, I do make sure that it's St George Illawarra. I know it doesn't mean much, and you know, realistically, I'd love to see the Steelers still in the competition. I think that would be that'd be excellent. But you know, just some things aren't meant to be, and it just hasn't worked out that way. Look, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you for a little bit of a strange request. I just need to. I'm doing a competition, well, not a competition. I'm doing a series coming up at the end of the year, where we're going to go through the years, and we're going to select a year to do like a season wrap. So I just need you to pick me a number between 1 and 4.
2.
Thanks, Luke. And look, if we end up with a year that the Steelers are in existence for, you know, I'd really love you to come back on and be my Steelers rep.
No, you've twisted my arm. If the Steelers are there, I'm there.
So let's hope we get something between 82 and 98, because it'd be great having you back on. My only problem is that at the end of the competition, I've got to do a bit of trivia, and I have to do trivia about clubs, and I might have to get you to write the questions for me, because I don't know as much about Illawarra as you do.
I can see what I can come up with. I'm sure I've got some stuff stored in the back of the brain.
All right. Thanks, Luke. I'll see you later.
Oh, you're a good man. Thanks, David. All the best, mate.